today is to go through the overview of the domain name system as such, the technology that you have, to look a bit at the history of the root servers, how have they evolved over years, the root server system today and its features, and also some RSAC activities. RSAC is the Root Server System Advisory Committee, one of the ICANN bodies. It's an advisory committee to the board. I am happy to serve as one of the two co-chairs of RSAC, bearing the load. It's a very small advisory committee and very, very narrow focus, but we'll get into that later on. Next slide, please. So first, a bit of overview over the domain name system. Next slide again. The internet has computers connected to it, and the fundamental identifier for on the internet is the IP address, the internet protocol address. Host that's connected to the public internet needs to have a unique IP address in order to, and you have to be reachable even if you only work as a client doing surfing on the network, because there are packets going back and forth, sending requests, packets bringing web pages back, for instance, or in a telephone voice over internet both ways. There are packets going both ways. So each of these endpoints need to have its unique IP address to be able, for the net to be able to locate the exact host. Sometimes you group of hosts behind a single unique address on the public internet, but then you have unique addresses in your local environment. That could be your home or that could be your office. And today we see two variants of IP addresses. We have the traditional IP core addresses, which are denoted by four numbers between 0 and 255, and we have the more recent IP version 6 addresses. They are much, much longer, and they use hexadecimal, the normal digits, plus the letters A through F. The uniqueness here is guaranteed by having the addresses allocated from a single pool of addresses. So the IANA, which is a function that is operated by ICANN, has the overall responsibility for the total pool of all addresses on the internet. But it's rather burdensome for the IANA to hand out IP addresses to each and every user on the network. So it's a hierarchical system where IANA delegates large sub-pools addresses to regional internet registries, RIRs, in the five regions, Europe, Africa, the Asia-Pacific region, Northern America and Southern America, or Latin America, rather. And within each of these regions, there is again a next step in the hierarchy where the region delegates addresses or again, sub-pools of their pool of addresses to the internet service providers, which in turn then delegate addresses to the users. Slide, please. In the beginning, the IP addresses were actually quite short. They were just one byte. Very, 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 very early days of the internet. But this form, the IP version 4 form that we see today, has been around for a long time. One of the problems is that they're rather hard to remember. Human brain is much better at remembering names than numbers. So, and also the IP addresses often change. You move your computer today to a new place and then it gets a new IP address. And how do you tell your friend that? Or how do you tell your friend that your internet service provider decided to assign a new number to your computers? So that's something prompted the use of names instead, names mapped that could be translated into these numbers. We also have the modern problem where an IP address may be shared by a group of people or a group of computers, or you have multiple IP addresses that serve as one single entry point to a particular service. For instance, if you have servers located in different areas, you may want to promote them using the same name, or you may want to have a resilient system where the client can choose any one of the addresses. You still want to promote it under one name. Main name system is a hierarchical system of names. Now, this picture, I've shown it many times. It can very easily confuse you if you don't very carefully. What I'm showing here is not a network. These are not computers connected with links. These are how the names in the DNS system are tied together. This has nothing to do with the hosts on the internet and fibers. And this is a mathematical picture of the database. How are the main names tied together? And there's a hierarchy in the names where you have a common root at the top, And this is a root server. This is the root in the name system. And underneath, you have a first layer, which is commonly referred to as domains. And then underneath, you have the second level domains and so on. These layers, you connect them together to form a domain name. So the name down here is expressed as www.cmu.edu, darpa.mil, alpha.usmc.mil.uk. So this is how you read the names. And then you have relationship between the people or organizations that are responsible for administrating a part of the namespace. So this is the domain name. For each of these names in the namespace, you can map other type of information to these names. You can say, the DNS system is a big database. You look ups in the database. And the thing you look up is the domain name. But you can connect different types of information to the names. The most typical one is I have what I consider to be the name of a computer. I ask the DNS system database, what's the IP address that is connected to or mapped to my name? And the database system will respond with the address. Far from the only thing you can put in there. For instance, if you use email, on the right-hand side of the at sign, you have a domain name. It's not a name of a host. Mail domain, and you use the DNS to find which server should I talk to when I want to send two small examples of what you can put in there. The DNS system is globally distributed. Mind you, when I talk about this, I talk about DNS on the public internet. So the DNS system on the public internet is globally distributed. There are DNS servers in each and every corner of this world serving its little tiny bit of the big puzzle. And the system as a whole is not coherent. It doesn't have a well-defined state at any given moment. There are always reloads happening. There are always small changes happening all over the place. Overall, it's rather consistent. It works. It sits together. And we say that it is loosely coherent. It kind of works because there are margins and there is leeway in all the corners. But it is dynamic. It changes all the time. And no way you can take a picture of the entire DNS system as it looks right now. And then again in Argentina and then somewhere in South Africa. That's how it looks. Next slide, please. So when you want to do a lookup in this database, there are two sides to it. Have a side that provides information. That's where you store your DNS, be able to look at or look up. This is where you pub your information. And you have client side where you consume the information. These are all the users that want to have access to the DNS information. In the middle is something that has a lot of names. One of the names is caching server, so let's use that. This is a helper's function, which is located somewhat close to the ISP. It could be a large office, probably has one of these caching. It's on the client side of the big network. So here in between is the big internet. So what happens when an end user wants to find out the IP address for the web server, www.example.org? Will ask for a specific record type in the database. It's called an A record, and it will send that DNS query to the caching DNS server. Now, caching here means it has a cache, which is a database concept of a temporary memory for things that it stores for a shorter period of time. So if it starts out with an empty cache, it knows virtually nothing, query, and it will have to try to find the answer because this caching DNS server works on behalf of the end user machine. Then go to a root name server to try to figure out, to try to locate this record. Because when it's empty, it believes that the root name server knows everything. That the root name server doesn't know everything, it knows only a very, 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 very tiny fraction of all of this. This guy doesn't know that yet. He's quick formed. Because when he sends the query to the root name server says, I have no idea. The only thing I can see is that the name you're asking for ends in .org, and I happen to know where the servers for .org are located. I can tell you that's the response that goes back here. And this machine realizes that it hasn't reached the final answer. It only got a referral, a step on the way. So it has to issue the next going to the servers for .org. Again, it hopes that that server will know the final answer. So it asks exactly the same question again. www.example.org, what's the address? This machine will say, I have no idea. But you can see that the name you're asking for ends in example.org. And I happen to know where the name servers for example.org are located on the network. So here's the list. Okay, one more time. Now the caching DNS server talks to a name server for example.org. And it still hopes it will know the final answer. The A record for www.example.org will provide the answer, the record that the DNS server is looking for. And that server will now eventually provide it back to the end user. And then use that address, the IP address we were looking for, to connect to the web server at the web page you're looking for. So the root servers are the entry point to the system. You can always ask a root name server, and it will never know the answer. It will always give you a referral. Can always give you one of two answers. One is, I see that your question ends in something here, org, .sc for Sweden, .cl for Chile, .museum, Stockholm, .paris, whatever. And it will know the list of servers working one level down. And it will respond type of answer it can get. The second type of answer is, that name does not exist. Will not know whether a name that ends in .org exists or not. It can see that it ends on .org, and so far that's okay. So it will have to come to the next level and know don't exist. Ends in a top-level domain that doesn't exist. It can say so right from the start. If you ask for liman.fnufgrch, it will say, does not exist, go away. Nope. So this is the how it all works. Now, there are two things. The caching DNS server here will hang on to every one of these responses, even only the ones, the referrals, because that will help the caching name server to take shortcuts. The next time another end user comes and asks for st.org, it already knows that there's no point in talking to the root name server because it will only give me a referral to the org servers. It doesn't know anything about things under .org. So I can skip talk directly to the org servers and then start the traversal going down from that point. This saves a lot of queries because every query where the caching server already knows something about that specific top-level domain, query does not have to go to a root server. Root servers don't have to bother with that question. So that relieves a lot of pressure from the root servers. And of course, that works on every ladder here. So the more you use one of these machines, the more it learns and the quicker shortcuts it can take in the system. Now, there are also mechanisms in there to make sure that you don't have information that's very old in here. So eventually the information, the cache will kind of die and things will be ripped out, but it will give a lot of good shortcuts here and relieve a lot of pressure from the third thing is that the DNS resolution, looking up this information, is something that precedes the actual transaction you want to do. None of you in here, as internet users, are interested in the records in the DNS database. Really, not when you use your computer. You're interested in making a web surf, making a phone call, doing a bank transaction, something else you want to do, and the DNS is helping you locate service that you want to talk to. So this is something you do before you do your real transaction. And you terminate the DNS resolution process before first DNS lookup, then web transaction. First DNS lookup, then phone call, or what have you. So I think we went through this. The root servers know only who you need to ask next. Knows for each and every one of all top-level domains the list of servers that you need to talk to be able to take the next step down. And the root servers truly have an updated list of all functioning top-level domains. And we talk about next slide, please. There have been some modern refinements to the DNS system. We are mentioned here. DNSSEC was added to gradually added to the DNS system, and this is something I actually very glad to say. DNSSEC, or secure the security extensions to DNS, add cryptographic signatures to the DNS data. That gives the user, or most often this being DNS server, the ability to verify the records. You have to remember that the records have traveled from, in the previous picture, the publishing side, they travel across the public internet and then to the caching DNS server. Journey across the internet. What happened with the packet during that one? Modify it? It's been passing at least 10 routers and probably tens of links, and we have no idea what happened. The signatures will give the DNS caching DNS server, the ability to verify the content and see, okay, this is actually what the publisher meant. This is, hasn't been modified in transit on the network. And this reduces the risk of spoofing, but it also means that the client side actually has to go through this process of validating, of checking the signatures, and that's a lot of mathematics, so it takes some resources. Substantially raises the security bar to something much better. To be honest, I didn't think that this would be implemented in the large DNS system during my lifetime. And that was not for technical reasons, political reasons. But I am very pleased to say that the root servers operate with the sign zones since several years back, and that is actually the U.S. Department of Commerce. There's work going on with privacy enhancements. When you send your DNS queries across the network, you reveal what you're looking for. These packets are clear, so everyone who is able to snoop, to look at the packet, can read what's in there. And they can read what you query for. And by doing that, they may be able to deduce some information that you don't want to reveal. So there's work going on to enhance the privacy in the queries in order to make it more draw conclusions from the queries that you send. There are various paths being explored, encryption or just sending part queries and so on. But there is work going on. Another interesting thing that we introduced some 12, 13 years ago explicitly in the root server system was Anycast, where we have multiple servers spread all over the globe providing DNS service from the same IP address. Now, I told you already on the first slide that every host on the internet needs to have a unique IP address, only a modified truth. You can, if you know what you're doing, you can work, you can provide service from the same IP address on multiple places on the internet, but something that requires very careful coordination and synchronization with these machines so that you provide exactly identical service from all of them. But if you do that, you can improve on the latency or resilience of the system, because with Anycast, you can remove any one of these servers for an extended period of time, and no one on the network would even notice the service, and it will start to carry its own load, and you can remove another one for service. And by putting the servers closer to the end user, you can the latency, the response time between the service much quicker. So the root servers versus the root zone. These are two concepts that we need to distinguish. The root servers, these are machines. They provide the service of responding, receive the DNS queries from these DNS caching DNS servers, and they respond with the appropriate records once in the DNS protocol back. It's currently limited to 13 names. We can have only a list of 13 names in there, but each of these names can map to many hosts using Anycast technology. It may show up as a single IP address, but in the case of iRoot, which I happen to operate and work for, we're above sites that provide the service using the same IP address. And many of the other, I would say most of the other root server operators also provide, are up in several hundred sites globe, which provide root service. The root server is a purely technical role. The role is to serve root zone. So the root zone is content of the database, and this is the machine that provides that content to the internet. The root servers are operated by the root server operators. There are 12 organ servers, and we will get into that later on. The root zone is essentially the list of top-level domains, and for each of these TLDs, It's the name servers, the names of the servers that provide service for that specific lane. In the next step in the hierarchy, when you follow the namespace going downwards. Mind you that the root zone makes no distinction whatsoever between GTLDs and CCT. We are now talking about the technical side of stuff, and the distinction between CCTLDs and GTLDs purely a political one, and it has or a policy related has no impact whatsoever. They consider both the root server operators and the root zone, the content of the zone, makes no distinction between them. The root zone is created and managed by ICANN, and when it makes changes to the root zone, it follows the policy that's set by the community. And here, this distinction kind of creeps in because. If someone wants to make a change to a CCTLD, that's a specific set of policies. And if you want to make a change to a GTLD, that's another set of policies. For the process of changing the content of the zone, once it's been changed, it goes into the root servers and they treat them all equal. It's compiled and distributed by the company VeriSign to all root server operators. All root server operators pick up exactly the same zone file from points that we've agreed on with VeriSign. And this is also, in itself, a very resilient system. So there is not a single point where we pick it up, but there is a number of points which are well synchronized by VeriSign where we can pick up, I as a root server operator can pick up this own file. And if it goes really bad somewhere, I can pick it up from a normal file server. I don't even have to use the DNS. And to be quite honest, so can you. The root zone is downloaded on your laptop here and now. And have a look at exactly the data that we show. There's no difference. It's the zone file. So there's no hidden magic there. Next slide, please. 12 different organizations that operate root servers. The reason for 12 versus 13 is that one organization operates two of the names. And these organizations have a very long history doing this. Focus really hard on reliability and stability. These four items here are truly the key issues driving the root server operators. So reliability and stability is one of them. Accessibility to all internet users. We honestly work very hard to ensure that all users on the internet can access this information. We work together. We cooperate on technical matters, and that works very well. We have a long history. We know each other well. We know what we need to do, and we meet regularly. Sometimes per year, we have technical coordination meetings where we sit down and hash out the things that we need about, which are usually not that many in the tech side of it. And we try to do this as much of a professional fashion as we can. Very, very important to us. If any root server operator made a mistake, the entire internet will know about it. And that's something that I don't want to have on my business card, let me tell you. These organizations are very diverse. It ranges from organizations that are government-funded and operated to private companies to non-profit organizations to academic sites, universities. So we have a wide variety of types of organizations. And that's actually a good thing, because if there is a problem that affects one type of organization, the other ones will not be affected by that. And we have a resilience between the different types of organizations. It also goes technically, because we each and every one of us chooses for his own organization which technology to use, which type of computers, which operating system, which software, everything we choose for ourselves. And we don't choose the same. Sometimes about it, and sometimes we even talk about it from this standpoint so that we avoid, you three guys all run this specific software, then I'll choose something else so that we don't are vulnerable to the same problems with the software. And we're also so spread geographically to some extent over the globe, not only with all the servers, because that's really widely spread, but also the home bases, the headquarters for the organizations are somewhat spread over the globe. It helps because we're in different jurisdictions and so on. So what do we not do? The root server operators are not involved in policymaking. We hate that. There are so many people that are so much better at that than we are. We like computers, we like the network, we like to make sure that everyone gets the response. Policy for who gets what name, I don't really care, to be honest. There are so many people out here at ICANN who cares about that. That slot's filled. I don't need to worry about that. Another thing that we do not do, and we are extremely careful here, is to modify the data. The data we work with is the root zone. We are extremely careful to copy exactly given and to make sure that that's exactly what's provided to all the internet users without any modification whatsoever. And you can see if you have the process of publishing a book, you have an author who writes the book and you have an editor who may make a few changes or suggested changes to the book. Then you have someone who actually prints the book. This is the big machine that prints the paper and binds it into books. That's us. We have no say about about the text in the book. Print the pages, we give it to the readers. We're the publishers, we're not the authors or editors. And this is actually where DNSSEC kicks in, because if the root server operators do not have keys, the necessary keys for modifying the signature, which means that if anyone of the root server operators tried to modify some information in the root zone, the consumers, clients, would immediately realize that because the signatures are no longer correct, because operators don't have access to that key, the necessary key to generate new signatures. The operators are involved in careful operation and evolution of the service. We need to follow what's going on in technology. There are new standards and stuff coming out. There is expansion of the network. There are new functionality, IP version 6, DNSSEC, what have you. We need to follow that. We need to evaluate and deploy suggested new modifications to the protocol, to the servers, to the network, because we do operate subparts of the network near our servers. We work as micro ISPs when we buy the service from our Anycast nodes. Main focus for us all the time is the stability. Rather, in my personal view, I would rather provide a service which is slightly slower, slightly older, what works every day in the week, than to be at the bleeding edge, provide the most modern thing, and it stops working for 2 hours. I wouldn't be a happy provider. So we take it very carefully, we modify slowly, we evolve with time, but we are definitely involved in finding the new standards, finding new protocols, and so on. So we're aware, but the stability and resilience, that's our first and foremost priority. So I'll go slightly quicker through this. The history of the root servers is... next slide, please. So back in the 1980s, the hosts on the internet were listed in a text file. This was like a Word document with name of the host, IP address. Name of the host, IP address. Host, IP address. It grew longer and longer and longer and longer and longer. And this file had to be copied to each and every machine on the internet. And eventually that became too much of a hassle. So a few smart people got together and invented the DNS system, and that called for root name servers. So just among them, more or less, they figured out that, can you run one of these? Do you have enough spare capacity on your computer? Are you well connected to the internet? Yes, sure. So there were four servers on the internet in the early days. We're now back in the early 1980s. You haven't even heard anyone mention the internet back then. You can see here where they were located. They were located at the Stanford Research Institute. The Software Research Institute, Information Sciences at USC, sorry. And Ballistic Research Laboratory, and the different type they were using. Jeeves is no longer with us. That died out. Bind actually is still used by... Eventually, the system was expanded back in 1987. So the two ISI servers were combined into one. So there's one less in the upper half here. But four new were added. You can see again that these are mostly military and research or academic institutes. So we have University of Maryland here. We have the U.S. Air Force. We have NASA. And if we continue to the next slide, in 1991, the first one outside the U.S. was added, and that's our server in Stockholm, Sweden. Norginet, which is the research work that covers all of the Nordic countries, being Sweden, Finland, Norway, Denmark, and Iceland, up in the northern part of Europe. And that was a big contiguous patch of internet connectivity days when the internet wasn't that prevalent in Europe. Slide, please. There is a limitation in the DNS protocol. When you want to retrieve a list of the root name servers, you send a DNS query asking for precisely that. And we said in the early standards that the response should fit in a packet which is limited to 512 bytes, 512 characters, a whole lot. So a group of people, Bill Manning, Mark Osterhorst, Paul Vixie, sat together and thought, and can we make this list longer somehow? And they did so by just inventing new names for the hosts, because they really know how the DNS protocol works. So they really know that inside these DNS packets, there is an algorithm that tries to pack the data together, so each space in the packet. And by carefully choosing the names, you could take advantage of that algorithm, and you could fit a few more in. So the servers were renamed to the letters that we still have today, and the plan was approved. And once that was accomplished, we had room for four more servers. So next slide, please. So you can see here how they were renamed. There had been a few changes to the list, but this is actually more or less the list of root name servers we have, plus the four that were added after. So you can see that nick.nordju.net was named i.rootservers.net, and it still carries that. This is still in place, this naming scheme. Slide, please. So four more servers were added, and Don Postel, who was the then head of the IANA, who is the central coordinator for the root service, used a set of criteria to select new root server operators. And one of them was need, meaning the areas that weren't well served by the existing ones. Another one was connectivity. The proposed host for a new server would have to show that they had very good network connectivity, so it was easy to reach the server once it was placed there. He also looked for a commitment to send and respond to traffic without any filtering of the content. Now, you have to remember that this was back in 1996, 97. There was no security DNS around, so you really had where there was a community consensus. He would travel to conferences and ask around. So in Europe, who would be good to provide service in Europe? And he would go to Asia, he would do various conferences in different places and ask around, form a picture of where would the service be well provided. Next slide, please. So this led to two servers being actually placed in different parts. So in Europe, the RIPE NCC, which lay there, the network coordination center, actually the regional internet registry for IP addresses in Europe was selected to run, which is now KROOT. And in Asia, the WIDE project in Japan was chosen to run MROOT and still does. Two more were added, JROOT, which stayed at Network Solutions, which was to become VeriSign, and LROOT was transferred to ICANN as part of when ICANN was founded, because ICANN took over the role to run the IANA, and it seemed like a good idea that they would also run a root name server, because there are connections between there. So that was there. Next slide, please. And in 1998, unfortunately, John Postel passed away way too early. And the root server operators who had been working with John Postel as the central figure coordinating all the root server efforts, realized that there's no John Postel anymore. There's no central coordination function ourselves. And we did. We met as a group of individual organizations for the first time back in 1999, maybe late 98. This was a very secret meeting, because we had no idea what was coming out of it. It turned out that we all agreed on the most central vital points of providing root service. Ones that we talked about before, the resiliency, using exactly the same information, the same root zone, providing unfiltered information, and all of that came out very quickly at that meeting. So we said, well, it seems that we're all on the same page. Let's continue to do this together. And there were a couple more things. We recognized all the other root server operators. So among ourselves, we say that, yes, you are operating froot. Yes, you are operating groot. Yes, I am operating iroot. And we all agreed on that. And we also decided to, if one of the operators would no longer like to provide the service, very, very proper notice well ahead of time so that the other server operators and the world at large. So what does it look like today? And what are the features of the root server system? We are now 13 letters, and we've been that for a very long time. Most of them, all except two, provide service on IPv4 and IPv6. You can see here from the list where who operates which server. So we have VeriSign, University of Southern California, Cogent Communications, University of Maryland, NASA, the Internet Systems Consortium, BENS, the U.S. Army, NetNode in Sweden. We are operating the Nordjanet server. VeriSign, the RIPE NCC in Europe, ICANN, and then the WIDE project in Japan. Today, we are much more well-coordinated. When we were at a meeting after John Purcell's death, there is a good number of servers spread all over the world. This is actually a dynamic map that you can get. If you go to the webpage root-servers.org, there's a dash and there's an org at the end, root-servers.org, you will meet this map. And it's a clickable map, and you can zoom in. And if you zoom in on Europe here, the 33 here will kind of expand and tell you exactly where these servers are located. And, of course, that goes for all the other regions as well. We are constantly working on improving the density of this map, each on our own merit. NetNode, we go around, we talk to people, we want to deploy more servers. And quite the other servers, the other providers as well. And we're almost at 500 servers responding to your root queries on the internet today. That's a massive amount of data capacity. So how is the root zone distributed to all these 500 servers? These are the 500 servers spread all across the internet. And each of these servers is operated by one of the 12 organizations, one of the 12 root server operators. It's located somewhere on the globe, and each operator feeds the root zone to these servers through their own distribution mechanism. So in the case of iroot, we have distribution masters in Stockholm, in Sweden, that feed our servers in Wellington, New Zealand, in Singapore, in Tokyo, in Johannesburg, in Porto Alegre, in Brazil, and in the US, wherever we have them. And we feed our servers with the root zone. Now, Kroot in Amsterdam, they feed their servers with the same root zone, and we all copy it from the distribution masters that are provided by VeriSign. And they, in turn, get the information they need from the IANA, which is operated by ICANN. But every change to the root zone that the IANA boards or wants to have pushed into the system is authorized by the Department of Commerce and their national Telecommunications and Information Administration. Yes! And of course, what's the reason for making changes to the root zone? Well, that's because one of the top-level domains has made a change to their technical systems. If the Swedish top-level domain wants to make a change, they have to talk to the IANA, say, oh, we want to buy a new service here for our TLD. Please make sure that that's reflected in the root zone. Okay, says IANA. Is this according to policy? And it looks to the CCTLD policy for... Ah, okay, fine. Then it sends off the request to VeriSign for NTIA to approve it and for VeriSign to implement it, and it will then be distributed to through the root server system. This may look as a very complicated process, but I can tell you once it ends up here, VeriSign, by the way, also add the DNSSEC signatures needed. in order to make sure that the clients can validate. Once it leaves here, it's a matter of seconds before it's out here. I would say typically less than 2 minutes before it's out there and every client. So if there's any delay, it's in the manual handling on this side. It's not in the tech. We already talked about the diversity. Diversity of organizational structure, operational history as well. We all have diverse hardware and software in use. We have diversity in operational models. We have in funding models, because this is a long-term undertaking. I've been working personally. The first time I laid my hand on the Swedish root server was in 1992. I've been along for a long ride. So it's a long undertaking, and you have to ensure that financial stability to provide this service for long term. We have common best practices for physical system security, for how to provision. We have to make sure that we're able to respond not only to all the legitimate queries that comes from all the users out there, but this system is occasionally attacked. We need to continue to work even though we are under attack. You shouldn't notice. Have you noticed? I hope not, because then I'm not doing my job properly. If you notice that we are under attack, I'm not doing my job. So we have over-provision. We have so much hardware out there that we're really, really working at being able to withstand or sustain every type of attack that we receive. I'm not promising that we can, but we are working really hard at trying. And we have also very professional and trusted staff. As I said, I know most of the other guys in this business. So if I have a phone call from someone and say, claims to be, I'm root server B. No, you're not. You don't sound like Wes. I'm sorry. So it's very tricky to infiltrate this community of root server operators, because we know each other well and we've been doing cooperation and coordination. We are much involved in various types of work. Many of us attend the Internet Engineering Task Force, the standardization body for the protocols, and we're there to see what happens with the protocol and also give our input. It's happened in the past that people have come with new DNS ideas, and we were forced to say, I'm sorry, that will not work, because load on the root servers, and we cannot withstand that. So they would have to rethink their ideas. We are involved in various regional operational environments, like the RIPE community, which is the European Operators Forum. We are at NANOG, which is North American Network Operators Group. DNS.org is an industry, I would call it a trade association, but it's an association for people who deal with DNS, not only root server operators, but there are lots of TLD people, there are researchers, there are all kinds of people that deal with the DNS, and they have lots of clever and good ideas. Also continuing here with APNIC and ARIN meetings, which are regional operators meetings, and also AFNOG for Africa. And we try to participate in as many meetings as we can. And we like to be, if you have any questions regarding root servers, come and talk to us, because that's the way we can reach you with our information. There is also permanent infrastructure to respond to emergencies. We have set up communication channels. We all have phone numbers. We have communication bridges. We have chat systems. We have mail systems, what have you. And these are put on stable servers that are dedicated for root server operation only. There's also coordination within established groups. I mentioned the Root Server System Advisory Committee here in ICANN. Again, ITF and OARC are places where we interact with the rest of the DNS community. Next, hang on to this one a second. You will note here that none of these organizations, actually, this is all DNS technology, and that's what we care about. Now, next slide, please. New requirements are put on the DNS system, and we follow that. We try to predict, we try to analyze, we try to track what we see into not only the operation, but also the standardization process and the processes that deal with policy. Because it can happen that the policy actually affects the technical operation, and we need to be in that loop by the feedback that gives the policy people an understanding of why their policy is impacting the technical operation and what negative effects it may have. internationalized domain names, for instance, DNSSEC IP version 6, how did that affect root server system? Well, we look at it. We take help of DNS OARC, which is actually the Operations Analysis and Research Center for DNS. We have researched that, doing statistics, doing predictions, and so on. And we coordinate and work on evolving the robustness and responsiveness. The Anycast is our best and biggest tool here. It has its own set of challenges, especially when it comes to internet routing, making sure the packets go the right way. Slide, please. There are a number of myths circulating out there regarding root servers. I'd like to have a look at a few of them. Root servers do not control where traffic goes. We have no control over your packets. The root servers is the thing you do before you do your... You're old enough to remember the number service in the telephone system. If you wanted to call someone and didn't know the number, you could dial a specific number and say, what does Lars Lehmann, what's his telephone number? And the operator would look it up in a database and respond back to you with my telephone number. Then you would hang up. Then you would lift the receiver again and dial my number to call me. Exactly what the DNS is. You do the lookup before you do your traffic, and once you have done the lookup, the DNS system is no longer involved in your transaction. And your traffic goes through the routers of your service providers and other service providers, the web server, the voice server, whatever you want to do, the mail. So root servers are not involved in controlling traffic. Also, only a small fraction of all DNS queries are handled by the roots, or do even reach the roots. Do you remember the caching? We talked about the caching DNS server, that track of all the incoming responses to be able to make shortcuts. Well, these shortcuts make sure that most queries never hit the root. They only go direct to the server that needs to respond as far as the caching server knows. And the more queries it receives, the more queries it needs to send, the more it learns. And eventually, when it's been running for a long time and has a lot of clients, it very rarely needs to talk to any name server at all. Depends on the clients using the machines. But if you have all your clients are trying to get to www.cnn.com, it will learn that very quickly, and it will respond from the cache. It doesn't have to talk to any server regarding that for a while, for a day or two. Yes, the administration of the root zone is separate service provision. The root zone is administrated at IANA, who gives instruction to VeriSign. The root server operators have no part in that. Get the root zone from VeriSign, we copy it verbatim to our servers, provide the data that we are given. Cannot even modify it, because if we do, secure DNS will immediately kick in and tell all the users that someone... none of these servers is special. You have a system of 13 letters, which most of them map to multiple instances, we call them multiple copies, in any cost. But all of these servers function identically. So ideally, you cannot see on the DNS response you're receiving whether you got it from froot or iroot. It should give the identical response. If it doesn't, we don't do our work right. There is no difference. The ordering of the letters has nothing to do with this. A root is not special in any way. B root is not special in any way. None of the others are. It's just a way to give them names. It doesn't signify that one is better or larger or anything. And root server operators are not hobbyists. Definitely not. We have been working with this for a long time. For my own organization, we have two business legs, two business branches that we stand on. One is providing DNS service. That is one of the big things we do. And we provide service not only for root, we do provide it for other DNS clients as well. It means that it's very much the focus of the organization to provide good DNS. And that goes for all my colleagues at all the... The organizations are different, DNS service. There are more than 13 servers. There are 13 letters, 13 IP addresses. But using Anycast technology, we now have hundreds upon hundreds of servers out there. So you no longer have to talk to one of the specific 13 means. Forget that. That was 20 years ago. And there's no single organization that controls the entire system. The root server operators are well coordinated, but there's no organization on top of them that has the authority to control all 12. We do coordinate, and we get along very well, and we provide a good service, we believe, but there's no one who can tell all 12 what to do. Try to create an organization that can tell the U.S. Army and NetNode have the same authority. Next slide, please. So if we now move focus from... Focus from the root server system, the root server operators, into the ICANN community, there is RSAC, the Root Server System Advisory Committee. The role of RSAC is to advise the ICANN community and specifically the ICANN board on matters relating to the operation, administration, security, and integrity of the server system. Now, that's the entire system, but it's only the root server system. We are an advisory committee that has a very narrow scope. Compared to all the other advisory committees and supporting organizations, this is a very tiny bit of the system, and that's the only thing we care about. We don't care about the policies for new ccTLDs. We don't care about the policy brand names. We don't care about the policies for... As long as it ends up in the root zone, it's our problem to make sure everyone can get at that information and use it. But who gets what name, we don't care. The only reason for us to get involved with the policy is if we see that it may have an impact on the service. There's a new policy put in place that says, let's create 1 million new TLDs tomorrow. We affect my service. I would probably say, do you mind going a bit slower so that we can make sure that we can ramp up our service in the same pace as you add new domains? If the policy says, let's add this new technology DNS, so, okay, let me check how that will affect us. If it does it in a bad way, your customers and clients will suffer. So let's cooperate and see how we can make the resiliency, the robustness of the system, that's our focus. We're not adverse to making changes. It happen in a controlled way so that we maintain the stability of the network. So this is one organizational picture of ICANN. There are plenty. So next slide, please. We're located here, so we are an advisory committee to the board. RSAC consists of representatives from the 12 organizations that operate root servers and liaisons to various other bodies. And we also have something called the RSAC Caucus, which is a body of experts, and which is actually a very open body. We very much welcome participation from all, not only DNS server operators who deal with DNS protocol, who deals with registries, who deal with general system administration, network. There is room for a lot of expertise in that body, and we very much welcome that. But we are an advisory committee to the board, so we actually have a liaison to the board, and we also have liaisons with the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, which has a much wider scope. They don't only focus on the root zone, they have a much wider internet scope, so they're much more advisory committee, but it's kind of a sibling committee for us, so we have a lot of common things to do. RSAC is composed of appointed representatives from the root server operators. Each has an alternate, or at least the ability to have an alternate, in case the regular cannot make it to a meeting or cannot participate the alternate in. We have liaisons going to the zone maintainers, the IANA, the NTIA, and to VeriSign, because they are the ones who generate the root zone. We have liaisons to ASAC. We have a liaison to the Internet Architecture Board, which, the leading organization in the IETF circles for standardization. And we have also a member, a non-voting... Our liaison to the board is, of course, non-voting board, and we also have a liaison to the ICANN NOMCOM, also non-voting. RSAC caucus, yes. Members of the caucus are all volunteers. We really need them because the 12 of us that comprise RSAC don't have the work capacity that we sometimes need to do research and produce documents. So that's where we involve the caucus. And the caucus is formally appointed by ARSAC. Now, that is a very, very, very small threshold for joining the caucus. We haven't said no to anyone yet, so please join. Next slide, please. Current two co-chairs of ARSAC is myself and Tripti Sinha was back. Would you please stand up? There's Tripti. The two of us are currently chairing the ARSAC. I mentioned that. So the purpose of the caucus is, as I mentioned, it's a pool of experts who helps us do research and produce documents. We need the expertise because the 12 of us, we don't have all the expertise we need in ENS and all the related areas. We need a critical mass of people. 12 of us are only 12 opinions, even if we can produce 14 if we set our minds to it. But we need a wider selection of people, more experience, and a broader spectrum of opinions and experience. And it's also an important way for us to create transparency. And it goes both ways. By having the caucus involved, we involve more people, which creates transparency, but we also are very transparent with who actually produces the work. So when the caucus is involved the document always the contributing members. So if you work in the caucus and you actually produce and help us create, your name will be on there because you helped us and you did good. But it also has the flip side, meaning that anyone who reads the document can see who helped creating this document. And we also have public statements of interest. Anyone who joins the caucus required to produce a statement of interest where they disclose their affiliations and they disclose why they want to participate in the caucus. And anyone who reads it, go back to this published there on the web, state, oh, that Lehman guy, he works for NetNode. He probably has some strange about this. Have they colored this document? So when you read it, you can assess and try to understand where people were coming from. And the caucus is also a framework for getting the work done, so to speak. When we interact with the caucus formally, we create something called a work specification, make a request to the caucus, and we look for a work party leader who can drive the work in the caucus, who will him, and they will respond back to ARSAC the outcome. And there are deadlines and there is the ordinary mechanics trying to make the work happen there. Currently we have 67 people, and 42% of those are from non-root server related organizations. If you want to apply, just send an email to rsac-membership@icann.org. It will be treated by the membership committee. We have Paul Vixie and Kaveh Ranjbar. Chairman, aren't you? He's in the back here. Go to talk to Kaveh or Tripti if you're interested in joining. Okay, publications. ARSAC was, for the first many years of its existence, not very well known for making publications, but we started to pick up. We actually have a very first called ARSAC 000, which... When ARSAC was renovated, so to speak, the organization 2 years ago, started out by creating work procedures for ourselves to say how should we work, what should our responsibility and how should we interact with others. So that's already specified. We have ARSAC 001, which is service expectations of root servers. When you talk about root servers, what do you really mean? What should you expect from servers and root server operators? What is and what should you not expect? So ARSAC 001 is one part of this. This has been somewhat specified before in RFC documents, Request for Comments, which is the Internet Engineering Task Force way of publishing documents. There have been a couple of generations of this, but the latest one in the RFC series is by now way over 10 years old, and it's no longer relevant. And we also arrived at the conclusion that the IETF shouldn't really specify operational practices because that's not what the IETF is there for. On the other hand, the IETF should have a say in the quality parts. What parts of the DNS protocol should you expect? So after some discussions, we ended up in splitting this into two documents. So we now have the operational practices, which is specified in ARSAC 001. And there is an RFC about to be published by the Internet Architecture Board, which is part of the ITF circuits. We'll look at the qualitative parts with specification and so on. The idea has been to release these in tandem at the same time. Right now, the RFC document is being held up in the RFC editor's queue. Waiting. There's some negotiation between the involved, but it's coming there. If you want all the gory details, come and talk to me afterwards. We published RSAC 002, which is an advisory on measurements of the root server system. The root server operators, of course, measure the system to make sure that it operates properly, and we do a lot of things. But we realize that we agree on what to measure, so that all of the 12 of us measure the same things so that we can compare the measurements between the server operators. That's what this document is there for. It specifies a number of rather basic things, but able to compare them and see trends. We don't really care about the exact numbers now, but we want to be able to see trends as this presses, as new GTLDs are being deployed, as new technologies are being deployed, what does it do to our systems? And we have a rather recent RSAC 3, which is a report on the root zone time to lives. Each record in the DNS system has a time to live, which means it specifies the time that the cache is allowed to store the record, clear it out, and go and fetch it again. This is the mechanism that makes sure that all data in your cache. It turns out, if you start to look at these TTLs in very great detail, combined with the signature lifetimes in DNSSEC, you run into some interesting corners where you could have problems validating DNSSEC because the timing issues where the TTL time and the signature validity time don't cooperate well. So we issued a recommendation to change the TTL values in the root zone, which has been picked up and I think is possibly about to be implemented. We have made a few statements as well. We have made a space statement on the IC proposal on the CCG CCWD Workstream 1 report. Also on the IAB liaison to RSAC, we have a little exchange about how the IAB and RSAC are supposed to interact. Yes, we made a statement before we... When that TTL problem was discovered, we made a statement to change the signature validity period in the root zone first, because that's actually a smaller thing. And then we launched a research party to figure out where proper fix would be, and that came out in RSAC 003. So these are all fairly recent documents. Next slide, please. So current work status... let me see what it says here. We have chartered a work party, so we're talking to the caucus and ask them to create a work party, create the history and technical analysis of the naming scheme used for... this is to document the technical history of the names assigned consider changes to the current naming scheme. I mentioned that we've had this b.rootservice.net scheme in place for over 20 years now. And can we make changes to that in order to make the system? Or can we today safely ignore that 512 byte limitation that was put in the specification years ago? Please also do some risk analysis regarding that, and eventually at the end make a recommendation to root server operators and root server management partners on whether changes should be made. And this work party meets weekly and expects to finish its work in mid-November. RSAC. Slide, please. I think that we are nearing the end, aren't we? That's the end of the present. Now I would be very happy to receive questions. And I have with me, I see in the back, several representatives who I'm sure will step in if questions go their way.
Hi, Lars. I'm David from New Zealand, losing my voice. Question around when the cache communicates route.
Yep.
What determines server response to the cache when there's hundreds and hundreds of servers out there?
So we had the picture where you had the end user, you had the caching DNS server, and then you had the root server. I showed only one root server in that picture. So how does that caching DNS server know which root server to talk to? When it starts, the cache is empty. There is no information there. So how does it know about the root server at all? Well, each and every one of these caching DNS servers actually has a creation file or corresponding information, lists the root servers, all 13 of them, because there are 13 IPv4 addresses and, I believe, 11 IPv6 addresses. They have to be there in the configuration file. Okay, so when it starts up, it knows about the root server operators, but it still doesn't know which one to talk to. This is actually, to be honest, software dependent, depending on the software that you run in your caching name server. But one method that is being deployed, and I think by more than one, is that it will choose one at random first, and it will send the query to that random root server. Now, for each one of these 13 IPv4 addresses, or for most of them, there are a number of servers responding from that IP address. And it's actually up to the routing system, not the root server operators, but to the people who operate the network, to carry that packet to the nearest one. Now, mind you, nearest, very strange definition on the internet, but there is a notion of nearest. All the routers out there know what the nearest one is for a very strange mathematical view of nearest. So it will send it to the nearest IP address for that IP address that its caching name server chose. Next time it needs to talk to a root server, it will choose another one, then another one, and then another one. And eventually it will have walked through all 13. And for each of them, it will record the time it takes. And when it's walked through all the 13, it will know which one is the...
Doesn't need to, it's the nearest one.
But that doesn't matter, because quick is of essence, distance is not. And it will hang on to that quickest one. But sometimes things change on the network. So eventually, from time to time, it will do the 13 walk again to make sure that...
Hello, I'm Meherban from India. I want to know who appoints root server operator. And there are 13 technical entities. There is any plan to increase? And as the internet usage is increasing?
If you take them one by one, who appoints a root server operator? John Postel does. Unfortunately, he's dead. So there is currently no process for appointing root server operators. At least I'm not aware of one. Not one that you can invent one in your backyard, but there's no one that is widely known and universally accepted. There is pressure to increase the number of root server operators, and RSEC is aware of that. I believe that work has to be undertaken to see if we can find a way to expand the numbers. But we also need to make sure that we expand the numbers for the right. For me, as a root server operator, the reasons to expand the numbers would be if there are people who don't receive the responses as they should. There are people who see intermittent service where there are interruptions, where it doesn't work, where there's delay in conveying new data. That would be reasons for me to look at deploying to establish new root server operators, find someone who meets the criteria, and then we first have to define the criteria. What are the criteria for becoming a root server operator? So there is a ton of work to do in order to create that process. It's nothing you can do off the bed. At the back of your hand. It's something carried out very carefully and very slowly.
I appreciate the clarification of all this. What risk is there at the caching server that does not become the authoritative information? Is there any, it's related, I mean, I know it's not your responsibility, but what responsibility is there that the caching server doesn't get corrupt?
Right. Is there any chance you can put that slide back up? We have several questions. One with the end user and the caching name server. You are quite right. There is a risk that server provides incorrect information back to the end user. That's definitely the case. But mind you, the end user has access to all the DNSSEC information, so the end user can actually perform the validation. It, it, it requires that the end user knowledgeable, has the right software tools, but the protocol allows for that. There's nothing in the way here prevents the end user from doing that calculation and making sure that he gets the correct data. That said, that's probably not the general case. And yes, then you have a problem with the caching name server giving incorrect information. But as an end user, you often have a choice. So if you start to suspect ISP, which is typically the provider of this service, correct information, at least on the working market, the ISP, who hopefully performs better, and you can, to be honest, you can run this service yourself. You can run your own caching name server, do on my laptop. Not that hard to set it up, but it probably requires your chance.
Play with GAP. I'm wondering if you would be so kind to also talk about a bit about how the operators are funded.
I don't know. I can talk for NetNode about the others would have to speak for themselves. I guess have a few here, and I would gladly see you speak for yourselves. In the case of NetNode, NetNode has two business branches. One is to operate exchange points for internet service providers. The other one is to provide the on the DNS service side, we provide the root service, of course, but we also provide DNS service for top-level domains and other high-profile domains, and that is a service we charge for. So we don't charge for the root service because there's no one to charge. TLD case, there's a TLD registry we can charge, and we charge for the service, and the money we charge is used to buy that TLD service and the root service. And we're in the fortunate position that TLD operators are often, because the TLD really depends on the root to work. Without the root, the TLD doesn't work. So no conflict here in interests. So for us, it works out. We provide that service, and we also have the change point where we have a revenue which we can use to cross-subsidize the root service. It's mainly dependent on the DNS service. Other comments from others, please.
In my case, which is DRoot, University of Maryland, we're self-funded. The university picks up the cost.
I'm Terry Manderson from ICANN. LRoot is funded by ICANN, and obviously and funded by all of you.
Kaveh Rangemar, KRoot. We are a technical membership organization of IPNCC. So basically, almost all ISPs in Europe, Middle East, and Central Asia are members of us, and KRoot is also funded.
Any more questions? Any questions in the Jabber room? Or?
No question in the Jabber room.
Okay.
So... thank you very, very much.
I should also thank the people who have produced these slides. These slides are not my own work. I know that Wayne Wessels has put a lot of effort in this. There are a couple of other guys who helped produce slides. I should also mention Steve Shang, our staff support, a lot with all these practical arrangements. Thank you so much. And thanks to all of you for coming here. And again, come and talk to me.
Now, I would like to ask the audience to please take a moment. We have a little survey. We're trying to figure out what kind of sessions we need to do next, and your opinion and perspective will really, really help a lot. It's a very short survey, so if you take a minute, please go ahead and fill it up for us.